No editorial notes. Okay.
What
so,
is that? What do you mean?
Meaning don't say things that are opinionated yet.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I've already done that.
I know. I'm trying to keep you guys from blowing your load.
I thought it was shit in the third season.
Okay, so we enriched...
It really seemed to climb for me in quality.
I
thought the new direction was a bold choice.
From the dusty mesa, a looming shadow grows, hidden in the branches of the poison creoso. She twines his vines up slowly towards the boiling sun. Then when I touched her skin, my fingers ran with blood.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, my co-host is Richard Wally.
I'm here. Do you want me to introduce you? I don't know, or should I introduce Keith? What am I doing?
You're introducing me.
Oh, I wanted this to be a hot mess, so that's why
I'm doing
this.
Okay, well, starting off just perfect.
Yeah, just starting off just how I wanted it. You are my co-host, Cassidy Robinson, from Garden Groove.
Yes.
Groove.
And joining us again is our ex-roommate back in Pocatello, Idaho, Keith Foster.
Wasn't I supposed to come on and do like a crazy character? Isn't that what you do on podcasts?
Yeah, who's your character this week?
Rex Whelan, the animal doctor with a heart of gold and rides a motorcycle.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's... I'm baffled.
I'm sure Rex Whelan would have a lot to say about television.
doesn't have a lot.
Not really.
Going
he's
on.
Too busy saving lives.
Did I ever tell you guys? Speaking of television, just random non sequitur. I have a relative living here in California that's on a reality show.
Oh.
No.
Yeah.
So Brooke.
No.
Like
is a star of a reality show. There's a show on Animal Planet called Pitbulls and Parolees.
Oh.
That sounds like someone in your family.
Yeah, well, you know what it is, right? It's like a kind of a rednecky show about this chick who, like, saves pitbulls or something. I don't know. I've never really watched it, but...
It's Rex Whelan's favorite show.
I bet it is. It sounds like it would be. But yeah, she's, like, on my mother's side of the family, like a fourth cousin or something.
Well, what's funny about all this is... In this hot mess, we never discussed that this is our TV episode.
Yeah, I was just about to get to that. Me and Richard, didn't want to talk about any of the movies that are premiering this week. We've been waiting for a hole in our schedule for a while to have an excuse to talk about what we're watching on television. Because, you know, there's a lot of great TV out there and we watch a lot of it. So we're going to try and sort of manage talking about what we think is relevant, what we're watching, what we have dipped into, what we're trying to catch up with, all of that kind of stuff.
We're going to talk about every show that's ever
Yeah, if you're watching TV, we're probably going to talk about something that you're watching.
We're going to start with I Love Lucy and go from then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, not exactly. But I did want to open up the discussion because everyone's talking about how television is the new hot medium right now for creative narrative writing, that film is kind of lost in the wake and television is now where writers go. It's the writer's medium for people who...
Well, and the actors.
Yeah.
And...
yeah. It used to be not too very long ago that if a well-known actor is to go on and be on a show on television after being established in film, that it was a step down. And now that's not necessarily the case. It can be a lateral move or even a better move in some cases. But
Keith or Sutherland.
Yeah.
I don't know why I brought
Well, he went from 24 to being in Pompeii, so I think he went actually down by going back into film.
But he's going
back.
But
he's going back to 24. Yeah.
So I guess I just wanted to open this up with a question. There's this whole, you know, the whole talk about the second golden age of television now that it's the new writer's medium again. And I wanted to ask you, where do you guys think the second wave started? Because I think my answer would take us back further than most people would say.
When the second wave started?
Yeah, when would you say this tipping point, this cultural tipping point on television, where it wasn't necessarily seen as a lesser medium or television as you've noticed it was started to become much more culturally significant?
Family Matters.
Did I do that?
The second wave as we know it today.
I think it started probably in HBO, somewhere around there. I mean, that's a vague answer, but I mean, I think somewhere around The Wire, or maybe even, I mean, maybe you can bring it back to Oz or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But since they've been tackling more serious, I mean, that's hard to say because I think there's always been good TV around.
Yeah.
It just wasn't
the precedent.
Yeah. So specifically for Golden Age, I think it was, I think HBO has a lot to do with it.
I think so too. And I don't know. HBO and kind of the loss of the single set sitcom. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know,
the three camera
NBC
setups.
Had a huge, yeah, like, with Scrubs and that, it sort of opened what you can do on a television show.
Mm-hmm.
Cause you weren't limited to, oh, well, how are they, you know, we can't let them get out of their living room.
Uh-huh.
I think you could even almost, I mean, even on that kind of like, line of thought, you can almost say, whether you like it or not, you can almost kind of say Lost, because that's when people really started to pay attention, and that had a huge, you know, cultural following at a time.
See, that's my answer for this question. I think, yeah, HBO was doing something different and new, and they were winning Emmys like a motherfucker when they first started doing narrative television with Oz and The Wire, Six Feet Under, Deadwood, these kind of shows. And then as they were all either getting canceled or on their final season, The Sopranos, Sex and the City, all of these shows were just ending around 2004, 2005, maybe a couple years before and after that. That's when Lost happened. And I feel like, you know, whatever you want to say about the show as a whole, I've actually still never finished it. but I think that was the first time narrative...
Spoilers, they end up on an island.
Yeah, there is that. Polar bears. That's when I really noticed narrative television, really coming back in a big way, at least since The X-Files and everyone trying to catch up with it.
I think it says something that, studios are still trying to have the next Lost. Mm-hmm. They're still trying to create that event television show.
Like The Event.
And they've been trying to replicate that formula ever since Lost. So I think that's actually a pretty good answer.
And I believe around the same time 24 started.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's kind of a messy like, yeah, pinpointing.
Exactly.
Well, and Family Matters ties directly into 24 because the dad becomes a cop and Die Hard, and, you know, then he has that.
That's that, no,
and
bullshit.
Kiefer Sutherland takes over for
him. He's part of the cop universe where it ties into Ghostbusters because he's a cop in that. And it's not until he tries to calm it down after his Die Hard episode that he follows down into Family Matters.
Yeah, and Jack Bauer has to pick up the slack. I'm telling you, everything comes back to Family
Matters. Sure, it's the new Lost.
Yeah.
Family Matter theories.
No, Lost is the new Family Matters.
Was. Shortly thereafter, we see, I think, the next big moment after that, because there was a lot of, like, scrambling to find its footing again as Lost was ending, them trying to sort of find a proper replacement, people competing like heroes.
Firefly, that's what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, and certainly I think the CW and Fox and those kind of networks were kind of doing interesting stuff, but it wasn't really catching on. I mean, a lot of those shows got canceled, like Firefly. But I think the next big moment was probably Mad Men and AMC deciding to rebrand themselves.
Yeah, AMC sort of took that first step into...
We can be HBO. Like, who's telling us not to be HBO?
Yeah, I think I think FX kind of stepped that way a little bit, too.
Yeah.
And I think as soon as AMC hit it, I think that they really hit their mark, started hitting their marks as well.
Yeah.
So it's really, there is a point in time where you can really see that it did explode.
Yeah.
It did, I think, started with the AMC, that kind of stuff.
Well, I remember a time when AMC was known for just, you know, showing Predator basically uncut.
Yeah. Or showing like Halloween 6.
Yeah. And now it's, I guess they still show movies probably?
I'm not sure if they do anymore.
Yeah, it's, they really changed the game.
Well,
yeah.
Talking about that then, we also have to kind of get into talking about the game and changing. We also have to talk, I never watched TV before Netflix, truthfully.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. I'm a binge watcher. I don't like commercials. I don't really like following them. I feel like the seasons are really strange and bizarre, and you have these weird breakups in the middle. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Why can't I have my TV?
Well, it's...
So that, to me, is also another game changer. I think you have a lot of people watching TV in a similar kind of streaming format, and also just being like, we want TV without the strings.
Yeah.
In a weird way, I also think the writer's strike.
Yes.
Even though for that season it killed so many shows, it sort of recreated like, well, what can we do with the season? Do shows need to be 24 episodes long? And they realized they don't, and they cut out a lot of those filler bullshit episodes. And, you know, even Lost is guilty of plenty of those. And then after the writer's strike, their seasons were a lot more focused. Mm-hmm. A lot more streamlined, you know, just get to the
good. Also, that's when you started seeing the rise of interesting things like half seasons, like breaking it up after 8 episodes, coming back 3 months later,
I'm not going to defend that as a
good I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it changes the way people write and record episodes now.
Well, I think that's also influenced by the British invasion of television by the BBC as well.
Yeah.
They've been doing the short seasons for a long time. And they haven't, and you know, they've worried more about the content and how good it is versus how many episodes we need to do it this many episodes and this much, and we have to pump it out to get our media.
They do series instead of seasons.
Yeah, exactly. And so you've got almost kind of more like a book format.
Yeah, chapters in a book. Yeah. And going back to the writer's strike, this was a thing that I thought about because I was reading a book earlier in the semester called Sleepless in Hollywood about how the decline of cinema and the rise of television. And she talks about that, the author, Linda Opes, talks about it a lot in her book. There's a whole chapter on television. And one thing I sort of noticed around 2008 when that happened was that when they cancel, or when all those shows were kind of on hiatus or just floating in limbo, they started bringing over all of these HBO stars shows, kind of editing them and like showing them in their place. And I wonder if that had an influence on what people thought, you know, certain audiences were sophisticated enough to watch.
Yeah, I think also just exposure, like, it was such a good thing for HBO because the only people watching HBO shows were the people who had HBO. Mm-hmm. And it cost money. Like, as a kid, I remember growing up, the only time we had HBO was on those free
weekends.
HBO weekends, yeah.
Yeah, but you weren't watching for the series, though.
No, I was watching, you know, for the boobs.
For the Red Shoe Diaries, yeah.
Yeah.
Emmanuela.
And so you can't get into a show over a weekend. You know, when you're going to see one episode, you're like, oh, that seemed like something cool was happening. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody got stabbed in prison. That was pretty sweet. But like Richard said, the idea of binge watching, the immediacy of, you know, TV on DVD.
Yeah.
And then Netflix, like, oh, I can just watch the whole fucking thing. I don't have to sit through Dancing with the Stars after.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Well, TV on DVD even really kind of kickstarted the binge thing.
That's true.
But And then, you know, I think a lot of us, like, watched Supernatural when we never would have before because of TV on DVD. But what I think Netflix and the streaming services have done is now there's this, like, willingness to experiment where it's there, it's free, it's out of your way. You can watch it without being embarrassed to rent it. So you can just, like, watch the first four episodes of something, see if it's something you'd be into.
I don't think I've ever had the embarrassment of renting something situation. Like,
well, I worked at...
I worked at a video store
where people would be like, yeah, my girlfriend's into this. It's like, dude, just get over it. You're into One Tree Hill.
Just watch Gilmore Girls,
I guess I just never... And maybe it's because I knew you and I knew, you know, all those people at the video store, but I guess I just never thought, like,
their
opinions would destroy my work.
Yeah, well, we're much more secure.
I guess.
You don't know our listeners like we know our listeners.
I think you actually probably literally know our listeners.
Yeah, we do.
probably
by name, even.
Let's go ahead and just get into some of these. Like I said before we started, I'm just going to kind of popcorn these. I have a list here of what we're watching, who's watching what. And I'm going to start first with what some of us may be watching and others not. Richard and Keith, do you guys have anything you want to say about House of Cards on Netflix?
Now the pressure's on.
Yeah, man.
What was your initial impressions of the show?
You're like putting pressure on us. My initial impressions, I mean, I think you get the initial impression from that show in the first like 5 minutes of the show.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, I guess. But he kills a dog right in the very first like 5 minutes of House of Cards.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
right up,
it is
you know
a mercy kill, but at the same time, it's got this like ruthless quality to it.
Kevin Spacey playing the main character.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have kind of a special relationship with House of Cards because it was a sick show for me. I was sick for like 3 days and just watched I was watching that, and I know we're going to get to it later. I'm just going to name drop it. True Detective at the same time.
Yeah.
And I was, after I was starting to feel better, I was just like, man, my life is fucking grim right now. Like, I just had no faith in humanity for a little bit. I was kind of worried when Netflix decided to create original content. Cause I was worried about the quality. Like, you know, were they gonna treat it with the same standards as network television? Or, you know, are they gonna go there like a premium channel does? And, you know, much to my delight, they go there.
Well, did you ever watch Lilyhammer?
No. I don't know what
that is. Also another Netflix original.
I think it was one of the first. Yeah.
It was one of their first. And you know what? The quality wasn't bad, but it just was lackluster.
Mm.
This was an interesting... House of Cards is an interesting gamble because they get somebody of David Fincher's quality.
Yeah, and Kevin Spacey. Oscar winners.
And it just ties back into the British Invasion thing because this is based on an original British television show, and they kind of mess around with the parliamentary system to make it the American political system.
Yeah, honestly, when I found out it was an import, I was kind of surprised because it fits Washington and, you know, like the political system there so well. And I don't know how much tweaking they had to do to make it fit, but it seems like it's its own thing.
Political corruptness is apparently just a natural thing to humans.
Yeah.
It could be in China and it'd be the same shit. Just a different language. No, I think that might be true about it. There's something just eerie about it. Now, the second season, you're at the same place I am, Keith.
I think right around the same area.
Yeah.
They definitely don't pull their punches. Now,
and I don't want to talk about the spoiler.
No, there's a big spoiler, and right off the bat, they get you going. However, I will say this about House of Cards. I think that there's a lull in the middle of the season. I really do. I think some of the episodes kind of blend together and they just don't have as much pizzazz as your start of the season, which, you know, is your David your super David Fincher infused, super stylistic.
Yeah.
And then it kind of gets more naturalistic, and then it kind of comes back around.
Well, see, I think that's sort of what happened to me. I kind of dipped in just to see, and I knew it was good. I was like, the acting's great, the cinematography's beautiful. I know this is a quality show, but it hit, like, I think I watched, like, the first four episodes, and then, like, on episode four, I could feel it plateauing, and I was like, I'll come back to this, I'm sure. And
but
then
you are notorious for doing
I'm really,
shit.
I'm actually bad.
You're
at
horribly bad.
Yeah,
you're really bad at TV, though. Like, if there's even a whiff of like, oh, that side character, he fucking sucks, I'm out.
And like, you don't even. It's not even like that. You just I don't know. You have the attention span of like. You go away for 2 days and you're like, what the fuck is happening? Who are these people? What, Kevin Spacey's in Washington? What show is this?
It's not even that. It's literally, it is a sort of an attention span thing, because if I don't watch a show, like, pretty much start to finish in a really intense binge, if I even let a little bit of time slip, I kind of like, I'm sort of on to something else.
Well, logic is actually more sound, because, okay, I know a lot of people are like, well, it's TV, you know, it's like a bite-sized thing. Bullshit. Yeah. People watch like 5 hours, 6 hours. You're watching 3 to 4 feature-length movies in that time. So I watched your logic is better.
That first day I watched House of Cards, I watched 8 episodes. I watched 8 hours, almost the whole season in one day.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of the mind state I was in.
That's coming up. That's Game of Thrones for me.
Yeah.
Well, but that's how it always kind of happens. However,
I'll let you guys actually just go right into Game of Thrones then.
We will, but I wanted to make mention on, because I was talking about, this is something that I think does happen a lot in TV though. I think that a lot of times in TV, the beginning and the end of a season, I think that a lot of times they polish those. And I think a lot of times TV shows actually have a tendency to kind of lag in the middle.
Yeah, I think even some shows can could do with maybe even a couple less episodes, or, you know, chew the fat a little bit. I mean, I think there are some shows that
I just think that that's
need
just
every second they have.
Yeah, I just feel like that's just sort of what comes with the territory. And if you're not into side episodes or experimental episodes or digressions, then middle episodes are going to feel like filler. I think the best thing to do with the middle of a series is to really, you know, just explore some specificity of the world rather than, you know, hitting the plot points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, honestly, sometimes I just kind of want to counterpoint a couple of things that were said here. I love setup. I love it. Oftentimes when I watch a movie or a show, the third act is my least favorite.
Same here.
Like the one where all the exciting stuff happens.
Yeah.
I love the build-up. And so if the show is rich enough, I can just get lost in, you know, the side episodes, just exploring something of the character. And I also want to make a point that there are some shows. Most of them I will binge-watch like I am a crack addict. But there are some shows that I actually prefer week by week. I like to wait.
I agree with
you're
you.
Weirdo.
In some cases, I agree. Okay, so do you guys have anything to say about Game of Thrones? I am not on this cultural bandwagon yet. I will maybe someday in the future.
Don't maybe,
yeah, you
just
will.
Do it.
He has to.
It's not going
to
be
part of his agreement for my girlfriend's HBO Go.
don't worry. See, this is one thing you can cut this later, but Cassidy, don't worry about it. It's not like you're not going to be watching Hobbit the TV show. I promise.
All right. Well, if it's not Hobbit the TV show, what is it? How would you guys sell it?
So that's my transition was going to be. So one problem that I sometimes have with TV is it lags in the middle. Game of Thrones is actually a different beast because you're basing it on a book. So the pacing is already there. In fact, you were already kind of talking about it, Keith. You were talking about how they have to like kind of ramp to try to get everything fucking in there. Like, really.
Yeah. And I mean, just like any adaptation, some stuff gets left on the cutting room floor, and you don't know that the Lannister's third cousin, Baratha Robodeer, is, you know, the guy with the fucking horn cornucopia in the background of the feast. you know, probably has a whole chapter dedicated to him, and that stuff doesn't make it to the show sometimes.
No, and it okay, so the show itself, though, okay, this is my, I guess, conception with it. It has almost nothing, it's a fantasy show, but has almost very little to do with fantasy.
Yeah, one of the things I've always liked about it is there is magic, there is dragons, but it's subtle, it's contextual, it's not just everyone can shoot fireballs out of their fucking ass. You know, it's a thing where you're like, well, is that magic? It leaves things to interpretation.
Well, it's about the political intrigue, and it's also the other thing about the show that's part of the reason I'm really into it. So I'm really into these weird side characters. But what it does is it breaks the traditional who your heroes are, the kind of Disney quality of fantasy, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I would say...
Honor doesn't win overall in Game of Thrones.
and there's a lot of talk about how, like, protagonists are taking...
Antagonists.
Verbiage, right? Antagonists are taking over television and narrative. And in a way, they kind of are. You know, you've got Kevin Spacey in House of Cards. You've got Walter White. You've got, you know, even John Hamm in Mad Men. But the thing about Game of Thrones is every character is equally redeemable as they are irredeemable. Like, there are things about the most despicable characters that you're like, oh, well... He's a human being. Like, he's a fucking dick, but he's a fucking dick living in this fantasy world that allows him to be.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's interesting. No one is a strict villain.
Like, probably the worst, most detestable of that is King Joffrey. Everybody, yeah. I think, can... But you understand that character's psychology. And
unfortunately,
well, you have to, because you can see that how he was raised, what he was raised around, why, how he got to what he is, you know, and so it's sort of an interesting. So I mean, this show is a fantasy show that's not about the fantasy. It's not about like, ooh, look, castles. I mean, there's definitely that kind of. Those kind of qualities in it as well.
Yeah, there's plenty to appease a fantasy fan.
Yeah.
But, like my favorite thing as an example of this is the White Walkers. I kind of forget about them. They're these frozen ice zombies that, you know, they're cool. They're zombies.
I think you're supposed to, though. Like, I think you're
exactly.
That's part of it. Because it's so much about, like, the human fucking fighting each other. That's what it's about.
Yeah. I always forget about them and the giants and the dragons take center stage a little bit more, but for the most part, it is about these people. And because of that, when they die, and I mean, it's not a spoiler to say that plenty of people die in Game of Thrones.
No, I think that's what it's known for. The show where people die.
When they die, it has an effect.
There's consequences.
It's not just, oh, that guy got eaten by a dragon. It's like, holy shit, you know, they died a horrible death.
Well, with the dying too, the characters that he kills aren't they aren't the likable choice, you know. And not only are they not the likable choice, it's they make sense.
Yeah,
that's why I'm saying it breaks the tradition of some fantasy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your big heroes. Just because they are good people doesn't mean that they're going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
There is a sort of calculation. It's a very interesting show. I actually think two of the small characters, like side characters, I think that they're the ones that are actually like the ones that are setting all this shit up.
You're getting into theory zone now.
This is a show though that has a lot of theories to it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and the book series too. I mean, there a little bit of context. There's still two books that haven't come out. Mm-hmm. The story isn't done. So even though people who are reading the books know what's going to happen up to a point, And the show sticks pretty well with the books. I mean, they alter some things. But they hit a lot of, you know, they hit the main plot points.
I will say the first season is almost exact. And it's very good.
Yeah.
The second season, I think because they tried to cut it down into a 13 episodes, I think that they kind of, I think that that's the least interesting. And I think it's the most messy and not the best season. I think the third makes up for it, but what the third lacks is specifically is they had to make up a lot of those plot points.
I mean, Ashley's read the books and she's, you know, kind of told me some things that are different, and I don't know. I think they do pretty good for having it follow that storyline.
Well,
but the thing that I think is cool and interesting is even people who know what's going to happen next in the books don't know what's going to happen next because there's still two books to come out.
No, that's, well, the thing about it also is that relevancy, because you're talking about like that the author physically hasn't finished it. So yeah, no, it's still relevant and people are still, it's really funny because when you get in groups that are talking about Game of Thrones, it kind of first you talk about the TV series and then the book readers, they all go in their little corner and all gossip and whisper to each other as the others look at them and are like, don't say anything, don't say anything. So
yeah, there were again, I'm keeping this pretty spoiler free, but there were people who were very concerned that I was going to have the third season ruined for me, and I somehow miraculously didn't and was able to experience it fully.
I think people in general are better about not ruining television than they are movies.
Agreed.
Like people, it's like an unspoken thing. It's like, oh, don't spoil that. But when in the realm of movies, they're like, yeah, fucking so-and-so is so-and-so the whole time. And you're like, really? You just did that.
Well, TV, everybody moves at their own pace with Netflix and DVD. So you don't know where anybody is at a given time. Whereas a movie, if you've seen it, you've seen it. If you haven't, fuck you.
Yeah, well, people are a little more considerate. It does seem like people are more considerate about TV.
Because it's a medium that more people participate in in a real passionate way. Yeah. We're gonna move on. I let you geeks talk about Game of Thrones long enough.
You're wrong. You have no idea what you're talking about.
We could do a whole podcast.
I'm sure you could. We'll move on now to a show we're all watching. Another Netflix original that really kind of caught me by surprise. I heard a lot about it, but I didn't really expect much from it. That is Orange is the New Black, the new show by Jenji Cohen, who had also did Weeds.
Okay.
Now, were either of you really big Weed watchers?
Yeah, I got up to the point where it got shitty. So like the fourth or fifth season?
That's about where we kind of...
Yeah, ended. It seemed like basically everyone sort of found a lull in the series.
Mexico. When they went to Mexico, that was pretty... That was a pretty dumb storyline,
and I feel like that's, you know, that, for all I know, could happen with Orange is the New Black, but so far we have one season out. They just, you know, shot it out there all at once, and everyone, it surprises me how universally liked this show is. Like, I know very few people who flat out don't like it at all. Like, I when I watched it, I put something on Facebook, like, oh, finally caught up with it, and, like, more... like various different kinds of people, genre of personality, like came on and was like, yeah, fuck, that show's awesome. And what do you think that is? What do you think people really dig on the show
for? One thing I wanna that immediately appealed to me was well written female characters and a well-acted female cast. Like, to me, it was very refreshing to see, oh, man, you know, women actually get a chance to do something on TV.
Yeah.
That might be the best, because, honestly, this is a show that's, like, it's not one of my fluff TV shows, but it's not one of the shows that I'm like, this is great. It's just really entertaining for me. But I think that that may be a better case, is just it's well-written females. And you don't see that a lot. And you're in
a gap.
And there's mostly, and everybody you're dealing with mostly is female in the show. So it's kind of, I guess it's refreshing in a strange way.
Yeah. And it kind of brings to mind some of the like exploitation women in cages kind of movies, like The Big Birdhouse and those kind of movies. But it kind of like updates it in this really interesting sort of post The Wire kind of vibe, but with like a mix of Jenny's other show, the Weeds, that kind of quirky kind of sense of humor. Like, it, I don't know, the way it all blends together is just kind of this perfect storm.
Yeah, another one of the reasons I like to watch it is because it's so watchable. It's not a Breaking Bad. It's not terribly intense from episode to episode. It doesn't leave me hanging on the edge of my seat. I'm more just invested in the characters. Like, I don't want bad things to happen to them, but I'm not stressed out for them either. It's just watchable.
Well, it's a show that will go there, but it doesn't have to go there, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, it definitely, there's some intense scenes, and there's some...
Well, certainly even... ended. The first season ended on a pretty intense note.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's drama.
There's definitely drama, but what I'm saying is, yeah, it doesn't have to ramp you up to the point where you're like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this anymore, almost. But no, to me, it's just easy to take in. It was a really entertaining, and I think I accidentally binge-watched that show. It wasn't like I was like... this wasn't one of the ones where I'm like, I'm going to sit down home and watch all of it. This was one of those ones where I was like, we'll see how good it is. You know, House of Cards was pretty decent. And, it was just so easy to watch that I watched it all.
It just went down really easily. Went down. Yeah. But it has such a cool, like what Keith was saying, a cool array of characters and different kinds of characters. It's not only is it fully female, but I mean, the show is wildly progressive in that we have, all races represented in a show in a natural way that doesn't feel like Rainbow Coalition.
Yeah, it doesn't feel exploitive. It's not like, well, that's the token black character. That's the Mexican character who only wears hairnets.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it plays on all of those cultural stereotypes, but in a way that's really intelligent and has an interesting discussion. Also, as far as its representation of queer culture, is totally forward thinking because it's so not what the show is about, but it is always in the discussion in a way that, you know, regular middle America is watching it and not thinking about it on those terms.
Well, I think it is kind of what the show... I mean, partially it is what the show's about because you have her...
Ex-lover.
They have the... It's the love triangle situation.
But you think of it in terms of the situation these characters are in, not, this show is really pushing...
And they're humans.
Yeah.
You know? It doesn't have to be, like, the perfect straight... perfect gay person or the perfect, you know, or they're a serial killer.
Well,
like, it doesn't fall into those two.
I think the setting really helps with that too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, putting them in an enclosed environment, you know, where these characters can't avoid each other. Like, it just can't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and having relationships spring up amongst them seems natural. And the fact that a relationship happened to exist before they were locked together, it doesn't feel any less natural because we're introduced to it through this world. Uh-huh.
Now, obviously, there is a certain amount of that there is a double standard when it comes to women versus men. If this was, I mean, you know, Oz, I think, touched on this a little bit, but I don't think as casually as...
Yeah, I think in Oz it was more use...
It's like, more like, you don't want to go to prison, this happens there.
Yeah, it was a threat. It was a... You know, you're my prag kind of. Yeah,
I thought you were talking about queer culture still, and I was like,
no, yeah, I am.
It's in prison. Oh, you are. Okay. Yeah. No, there is. There's kind of more. It's kind of interesting because there is more of like a relationship quality to Orange is the New Black.
Well, it's
whereas in Oz. I remember it was mostly like there's definitely gay characters, but
wasn't it's.
It was more survival than
yes. And there's some of that in Orange is the New Black, too. But, I mean, we have, like, a full-on transgendered character played by a transgendered actress, which is really new and different. And I don't know. I'm surprised by how mainstream the show is. Like, I remember we were, like, having lunch or whatever, and my sister was like, oh, my God, I'm addicted to the show. Like, I get really excited to get off of work so I can keep watching it. I don't know. I'm really excited for the new season. I think it's starting up here pretty soon. And I'm excited to see where these characters go. I hope that it doesn't hit that wall like Weeds did.
Yeah. I honestly, I think it's got at least a couple seasons.
Yeah, I think if they know when to say enough, it'll
well,
be
I
good.
Mean, that's another thing, too, is TV... That's another thing, like I was talking about the lag in the middle. TV shows do have a tendency... I think people have different theories on it, because some people, it's like, it's always the first season is the best. I actually think the second and third are usually the best seasons in TV.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, after four-ish, a lot of TV shows do tend to go downhill, and I don't particularly... I guess the show creators just get fucking tired, because they're making, you know, 10 movies. 10,
I think...
10 short films.
Yeah, I think, like, 5 to 6 seasons is optimal. You know, 7 to 8 is starting to push it. Anything beyond that is, you're really lucky if you have quality stuff after 8 seasons.
Yeah. I mean, 8 is, even seems long now. I feel like 5 is the natural cutting point.
Five or 6, cause you've got that, you've kind of got a natural, you know, 3-act arc if you're building off of like season 1, season 2, season 3 hits a story, then you know you could do another longer story off of that. It kind of feels more natural because I don't know, just in our culture, storytelling 3 is the magic number.
Well, for sure. I mean, this gets kind of like into the form as well, because I mean, television is kind of more like a book in that sense.
Well, it has become. I mean, if you go back to like Law and Order and CSI and those kind of shows, every single episode is a reset. You go back to zero and start with a brand new story. Whereas now people are thinking of it in terms of the binge, where they think, how is this season going to have an arc?
No, that's true. Because
that's
they used to wanted you to be able to, this is kind of why I used to not like TV, is because they had this old rule, like a person should be able to pick up in season 4 should be able to pick up the series and like it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to me, it just made the series really repetitive and not very good.
Yeah, and you'd have, you know, guest actors come and they'd be in the one episode and you know nothing.
Their character's not going to
really
have,
important can happen.
Or they'll have to die or something like that.
They might get a 3-episode arc if the audience is lucky enough and likes the character.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and move on to AMC Mad Men, which we talked a lot about in the opening of the show, of kind of where this stuff really started and got big. I'm a couple seasons behind. I finished season 3, and then I need to dip back in. And I almost feel like I need to start from the beginning again, because the show is so dense, but it's also really subtle, and there's so many little tiny things that are happening with the characters that are kind of briefly mention and then come back a season later.
Yeah, there are even, you know, characters and storylines that I forget from season to season because of that subtle touch.
Yeah.
Which I really like. It feels, I don't know, I think it gives an element of, you know, these are real people kind of thing, because, you know, people can just blow in and out of your life and not really impact you, but it still feels like it makes sense, you know, for the overall story.
Well, yeah.
For me, this is I actually think Mad Men is the best TV. Like, I think it is the pinnacle of what we've seen so far.
I only think it is when I'm watching it, and then I forget how good it is.
I agree.
Like, between seasons. Exactly.
Because it is, there's nothing about it that's, you know, it's not, unlike Breaking Bad, which we're not going to be able to get into because a few of us are not caught up.
Yep. You're bad at TV.
We're bad at TV.
We know this.
But unlike Breaking Bad, unlike Game of Thrones, unlike some of these shows that are much more plot-driven, Mad Men is I mean, it's one of the most intensely art-directed shows ever made. And it's just... I mean, I think you have to really get off on art direction, get off on, like, the way they decide to shoot something, or the way to, you know, it's almost sort of the cinephile's television.
It's sort of boggling to me how big of a hit it became because of that very reason. Like, you really, it pays so much attention to detail, to period, to mood.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of episodes that are very mood based.
Well, also the consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is my other thing that I really actually, for me, this show was a surprise. Because if you would have told me this is the kind of show that I would consider some of the best TV, I would have laughed in your face.
I actually, I kind of agree. Just knowing you, and it is sort of a surprise to me how much you ended up enjoying it. I'm glad you did, because it's great. But I would not have predicted that.
Well, the thing about it is, see, why I think it's such, the quality of the show is so great is because of the things you've mentioned, but it's also just because the show isn't aimed it's different. It's experimental. It's all of these things, but it's not.
It's almost Fellini TV.
It is. No, it is in a lot of ways. And that's what I'm saying. This is not a normal TV experience.
Yeah.
There's some episodes in there that I've never experienced in the cinema or in TV. So yeah. It's like, sometimes this is like breaking new ground, weird stuff for me.
Oh, certainly.
And for another me to thing be about... into the characters as much as I am, and not, and them to just be like ad guys.
Yeah.
It's pretty, I think that's remarkable.
And per season, very little actually happens. If you're talking about like, what was the big major events of the season, you can maybe bring up one or two things. A lot of the show is just, you know, soaking in the milieu and watching these people live their lives in this very observational, cold, detached, way. And I know there are a number of people, for as popular as it is, who think it's extremely boring, and they're never going to get into it, because I think you have to really enjoy the tone, which is a little offish.
Well,
another thing about this show that I think separates it from a lot of TV is it gets better. Like, I think, to me, anyway, as I'm watching it, each season is better than the last one. And I can't think of a show that does that like that. You know, a lot of shows have ups and downs. They have, you know, they have high points and stuff. To me, seriously, every season is better than the last.
I can agree with that. The other thing, too, I mean, this show, basically what I'm getting from our conversation so far is it's hard for us to pin down, but we know it's great.
Yeah. And
yeah, we all want
to... Well, it's one of those things...
Man, Man's Dick.
You can't really describe it unless you watch it.
Well, no.
Yeah.
One of the and there's so much texture and just beautiful quality to it, because I was reading this interview by the guy that plays Pete. Now, Pete is kind of like the show's Joffrey for Game of Thrones nerds. people hate him. Generally,
but you sort of love to hate him.
Well, the thing about him though is he says I haven't done anything in the show worse than Roger, worse than Dan. He hasn't. Yeah. His actions in the show are no more, you know, morally are no more deplorable than any of the other characters. In fact, most of the other characters do worse things.
Yeah. But he's just such a douche face.
But that's the thing is he talks about kind of how his character, it's almost about charisma.
Yeah.
And the difference between him as a person in society and a Donald Draper in society, or a Penny,
and I think that's a
versus what's her name,
Joan.
Yeah, you know, so
and I think that's a credit to the performances too.
Top notch performances, and nobody's like is overacting or begging for an Emmy. They're all to support everyone else.
It is a show that I think continually gets snubbed at awards, and I think critics and even viewers kind of take it for granted, because it's just sort of, you know, like the first couple seasons blew everybody away critically, and now it's just sort of like, oh yeah, Mad Men knocks it out of the park again, okay. Big, you know,
water's
it's
wet
not a, they've yeah. been doing it so consistently that, you know, if there's even a hint of a misstep, there was an article I read that like trashed one episode last season and raved about the next one and had raved about the one previous. And I was like, really? Like one episode? And it, like, come on guys, give it a break.
I have kind of a kind of a dumb question. Who are your favorite characters in the show?
I love,
you know,
Don.
I'm forgetting
it's
names cause
because
it's been
I
a while,
actually
but
like Don as a person, it's cause I just think he is such a conflicted well-drawn character. I don't know. He's so enigmatic and charismatic that you can, I don't know. I think you can't help but like him.
Yeah. Who is the one guy who smokes a pipe and has a beard?
Wow.
I know.
Jesus, which season?
Well, he was in the first three seasons at least.
I think I know the character you're talking about.
He was a copywriter. He worked alongside Peggy.
He's the one that ends
he had a black wife.
He's the one that ends up.
You're
not gonna spoil fucking.
You're bringing up characters from fucking three seasons ago.
Oh, I enjoyed that character. That's all I was gonna say.
Well, he ends up. He ends up in the religion. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, I love Joan. I think she, you know, she's such a spitfire, and she's so willing to just like put it all out there. What I was saying is, I think, you know, Joan's so interesting because she's pre-feminism. And in a lot of ways, the way that she kind of uses her sexuality for power would be almost anti-feminist by, you know, at least by the 70s standards. But she's so in control. And then that's in amongst, you know, this big boys club. It's so interesting to watch.
Well, I love Joan in contrast to Peggy.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because Peggy.
My two favorites are Roger and.
I do love
that. I love Roger to death, and I love. Him in context to Joan as well.
Yeah.
Because he is such a child. Like, he really is. He shouldn't be at the head of a corporation.
Oh, and...
Well, this show is so about, like, you know, relationships and how those characters interact. Because, you know, a scene with Roger... Yeah, a scene with Roger and Don is going to be so different than a scene with Roger and Joan. And they're both going to be just... dynamite and so fun to watch because of the way the characters interact.
So Mad Men, we all think it's great.
Yeah, I'm actually talking about it. I really want to like start watching it again.
Real quick before we go on, can anyone say anything bad about Mad Men
up to the point that I left off? No,
I can't. Like, again, for me it is, I think you put it in perspective, to me it is Fellini TV.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that about it.
And I'm not even that big of a Fellini fan, but, you know, I love, I don't know, I guess maybe it just translates better to TV for me or something.
Just the mood, the atmosphere, everything. I also think you need to watch more Fellini before. I mean, Dolce Vita is good, but...
Sure, let's not get into Fellini.
Yeah, motherfucker, just...
The Fellini cul-de-sac here. All right, let's go ahead and move on to something me and Keith are watching, and you are not, Richard. Go back to HBO, half-hour comedy, smash hit show, Girls. I've had a weird relationship with this television show, because I kind of jumped on the bandwagon when the first season came out on DVD, because I didn't have HBO at the time. And I'd heard a lot about it. There was a lot of things written about it. I don't know exactly what I was expecting. Maybe something more like Sex and the City. And when I started watching it, like the first like few episodes, I was like, this is a show I've always wanted and never knew I always wanted it. The writing was so sharp. The characters are so flawed in interesting ways. It kind of, you know, it's written and directed and produced by Lena Dunham, who's 25 years old, kind of almost child prodigy. She, you know, had her first film, Tiny Furniture, which was released by the Criterion Collection before she even got to do the show, was picked up by HBO and co-produced by Judd Apatow. But there's something about the way she writes youth culture, even though, you know, the youth culture she's writing about is very specific to upper-class New York rich kids, that nobody, you know.
Yeah, I hated the whole bullshit, like, there's not enough diversity in the show.
That's not what the show's about. Yeah, but the way she wrote dialogue and the way she wrote about their concerns, the way they use social media, it all feels really natural, and it doesn't feel shoehorned in there like when other people try and do it.
I'm actually going to play a little bit of devil's advocate.
Go for it.
On this one. For me, Girls was much more of a slow burn. I mean, I wasn't crazy about the first season. I don't know. To me, it was so pop culturally savvy, and I know you've criticized other shows for this, you fucks, so don't even...
You're not wrong. It didn't bother me, but you're not wrong.
I haven't.
It's so pop culturally savvy that it kind of almost felt artificial to me in the first season. And then, man, this is one of those shows that described perfectly what I was talking about when we were talking about Mad Men with peaks and valleys.
Yeah. Like,
there were some great seasons, or the great episodes in that first season. Mm-hmm. And I thought there were some fucking awful ones too. And I felt the same way about the second
season.
See,
that's where I was going, is that I after really liking the first season, I thought, you know, there was maybe a couple filler episodes, but basically I really enjoyed it where it left off, and I was really excited for the second season, and when I bought it and kind of watched it, because this half-hour show, so you can kind of burn through the seasons pretty fast.
Yeah.
I thought the second season really dropped the ball for me. I felt like all of the controversy that surrounded the show, whether it be Lena Dunham's nudity, or the representation of women, all these things that I thought were kind of non-traversies, I felt really kind of grating on me on the second season. And I was about ready to give up on it until this third season has been fucking knocking it out of the ballpark.
That is where I agree with you. The first season, I kind of left off in a place where I felt like I didn't really know who these characters were. Like, there were some clever, you know, episodes and things like that, but I just never felt like I knew them.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second season, I felt like I knew them
and hated them.
And then, but I agree, this third season, I think Lena Dunham has finally found
that balance.
This good balance of, you know, savvy wit with character flaw and she knows her characters now. Mm-hmm. She knows how to write them and put them into situations that will not just push the envelope, but be interesting to watch.
Yeah, and it's a tricky balance because sometimes a show feels really kind of heartfelt and warm and natural and realistic, and then there's other times when the show's really arch, and she'll go for a punchline, or she'll go for a kind of sitcom-y setup. If she knows there's a joke that's worth it at the other end. And it's a tricky balance to try and do both throughout the whole show. I will say the only
I don't think it's a balance she's always found.
No, like I think said, the I third think... season so far has done it the best. But I think there is, I think the character Marnie, played by Allison Williams, has still yet to recover from the second season fully.
Yeah, I agree. She's kind of in this limbo. I don't know. It's
they kind of don't know her and Shoshana. I feel like they don't completely know what to do with at this point.
I love Shoshana. I don't know. To me, she just kind of is there. She's that you know
she's the
friend
Phoebe.
That is. She's like lurking in the background, and every once in a while, she just drops these amazing
one-liners.
Lines.
Well, there's this one great episode. I think it's kind of, I would say so far the centerpiece of this season, where they go to a beach house and it becomes a Tennessee Williams play. When the episode was over, and I'm not the only one to say this, so I'm not that clever, but I was like, oh, it's Girls in the Band. There was a William Friedkin movie from the early 70s called Boys in the Band about a bunch of angry gay guys getting furious at each other in a house. Is based on a play.
Okay.
A very Tennessee Williams-esque. But anyway, I thought that was a really great episode. And Shoshana fucking, I was like, thank you. This is what I've wanted from you this whole show.
Yeah, she said everything that every audience member has been thinking.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about Shoshana is I don't necessarily need this, you know, compelling story arc with her. I think she serves her role well. And
kind of being the Greek chorus of the group.
It, yeah, and as long as she keeps writing her that way, I think it works.
Now,
so
I will
why
say,
should I watch the show?
I would say give it a shot. There is a little bit, like, if you're a fan of Freaks and Geeks, and you're a fan of, like, the Judd Apatow television, there is an edge of that in this. I mean, it's Lena Dunham brings very much her own perspective, and it is really her baby, but I would say it's not just for girls in the same way that Sex in the City was. Also, there's great male characters. Adam Driver is oftentimes a scene stealer every time he's on camera.
He,
The ugly guy and that was going to play Nightwing. And is now
who's
Darth
now,
Vader.
Like, in everything.
Yeah.
but you know, there's a reason. He's very talented. He does have this charisma. Like, you want to watch him.
Yeah.
He's unpredictable. He is a great character. I really enjoy the character Rex.
Yeah, they've really
built
him up.
One of my favorite episodes from the second season was the episode titled Boys, where it focused on these two characters and this shitstorm of emotional awfulness that these female characters have dragged them through.
Yeah.
And they just sort of get to deal with that in this weird guy way.
Yeah.
And it rang very true, but in a very bizarre, surrealistic way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's moments like that where the show shines, where she's writing with a purpose.
Yes. In a lot of ways, the interesting thing about Lena Dunham is I she's very young, and sometimes her youthful naivety comes through in her writing, but I'm almost in a way watching now because I'm more excited about Lena Dunham 10 years from now.
Yeah. Something I think is cool and strange is the way she uses, like, social media and pop culture in general to influence her. She's very receptive of the criticisms of the show.
This third season felt like she took my notes and applied all of them.
Well, she did. She would, like, respond to people's tweets and emails, and she does it in a way that doesn't feel pandering.
No.
Which I think takes talent.
Yeah. And humility.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's girls.
Cool. That's girls. Okay, Jabber fans, I just wanted to give you a heads up. This episode is in two parts. We had a lot to cover, and we didn't even get to cover most of what we wanted to talk about. We barely put a dent in our shortlist before we started recording. So, once this episode is over, part one of episode 78, there is another part that you can download separately, and in that part we will be talking in great detail about True Detective, so stay tuned, and please download both parts. All right, bye-bye.